licensed professional myself, and I take my cargo security seriously. Here, let me show you my credentials. The Russian reached into his coat and pulled out a thick leather billfold and handed it to the inspector. Borutin opened it. On one side of the billfold was Voroshilov's maritime license, with photo and rank and ratings. On the other side was a thick wad of large denomination rubles, about a month's worth of Borutin's wages. Everything look in order? Voroshilov smiled broadly. The inspector glanced back at the wallet. He was newly married, living in a cramped one-bedroom apartment with his mother-in-law, who slept on the couch. The cash was very tempting, and no doubt more would follow if he cooperated on this occasion. Konev must have worked a sweetheart deal with this man a long time ago. Mafia, maybe? It didn't matter. It's not the way his father had raised him. The inspector shook his head as he handed the billfold back to the barrel-chested mariner.
I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I must do my duty.
I understand completely, Voroshilov said, and I'm truly sorry. Borutin's eyes flashed blinding white as the wrench slammed into the back of his skull. The white-hot agony crashed his central nervous system, dropping him to the cold, wet asphalt. The gentle rocking woke him. His eyes fluttered open. Borutin's throbbing brain ached unbearably, each beat of his heart another nail driven into the deepest recesses of his skull. He was just one step removed from unconsciousness. The rocking motion stirred him like his wife's gentle hand on a cold, frosty morning, easing him out of bed. As his mind opened further, his nose filled with the stench of chemicals. The rest of his body protested too, aches and pains everywhere, his wrists especially. Tied, perhaps? He glanced down at them, but it was too dark to see. A slight twist of his battered head revealed a series of jagged patches of dim light. Holes, stabbed into the wall in front of him. Another twist of his aching neck showed holes above as well. Now he felt the contours of his body. He was twisted up and nearly fetal, his shoulder pressing hard against a smooth, curved surface. His legs? Numb and bent beneath him. He tried to reach up with his dominant left hand, but it was weighted down, zip-tied to his other hand. He lifted his bound hands together with a groan and touched the oily, round surface with the holes in front of him. Cold, like metal. He was inside of a steel drum. Panic shot through him like an electrical current. His breath came in short, sharp gasps. "Calm yourself, idiot," he whispered through clenched teeth. "Think." The rocking motion told him he was being transported. How? A car? No, too small. A truck. He glanced back up. His blurred eyes couldn't make out the distant shapes passing through the holes. Why the holes? Air holes. Good, he told himself. They didn't want him to suffocate. That was something. But where were they taking him? To kill him? No, they would have already done that. Good, he told himself again. But he couldn't just lie there, cramped and broken in the dark. What should he do? He reached up toward the holes above him with his bound hands. Perhaps he could push the lid off. He pressed as hard as he could, shooting pain throughout his torso. Nothing. His numbed legs and back robbed him of any leverage. He raised his hands again toward the holes. Damn it! The jagged steel sliced through the tips of his fingers. His hands jerked back, the sudden movement shooting even more pain through his cramped and injured body. Hey! Hey! Can anybody hear me? The steel barrel suddenly tipped forward as it clanged to a stop, his head smashing perilously close to the jagged air holes in front of him. Borutin pulled his face away from the steel wall. He suddenly realized the barrel had been tipped at an angle before, and now it was vertical. And still, what did that mean? The sound of scraping metal screeched beneath him as the barrel jolted forward a few inches, then came to rest again. Hey! Help me! Get me out of— The drum pitched forward again. Borutin's entire body fell against the steel wall, as if laid down to bed. A heartbeat later, a tingling sensation ran down his spine and exploded in his gut as his body floated away from the steel wall, weightless.
What the hell?
His battered brain suddenly understood. He opened his mouth to scream. Wham! The curved steel wall smashed Borutin's face like a hammer blow, breaking his nose. Cold water poured through the air holes, seeping in from the sides, gushing in from the top, filling the barrel quickly.
Not air holes, he realized in his blind panic.
Borutin cried and mewled, kicking his bound feet uselessly against the drum floor, which was layered in rough concrete for added weight. He slammed his hands against the lid, shredding his fingers like a serrated knife. All wasted effort. Nothing budged. Water poured in faster. What shadowy light remained melted away. The drum righted as the ice-cold sea flooded in, leaving an air pocket at the top, just enough for Borutin to scream his last in the dark before the barrel finally slipped beneath the waves. Borutin's death was slow. His last cries were baffled by the frozen seawater sucking into his lungs, burning his sinuses. Trapped in the blinding dark, mindless terror crushed his chest as his spasming throat locked up, pushing iron-blue salt water deep into his belly. His eardrums burst as the barrel plunged deeper into the watery abyss. The drum finally settled in the rocky slime some 900 feet below the surface of the merciless sea. His lifeless mouth opened in a perpetual silent scream. Chapter 23. San Francisco, California. Feng was at his standing desk, coding. Or should have been. He was exhausted, mostly from worry. The conversation he'd had with Watson 2 days before still haunted him. When he'd left her office to chase down the IoT printer project, he was certain he'd satisfied her curiosity about the NRO workstation. But as the days passed, he began to question his assumption. Maybe the enormous relief of just not being arrested on the spot had clouded his judgment. At the time, he thought he might have been suffering a panic attack. But her query was easily dismissed, and he thought no more about it until he woke up in a cold sweat that night. A coincidence? The fact that the very workstation he was stealing information from was the one Watson had a question about? Sure. She had put him onto the task to fix it in the first place, and it was reasonable for her to follow up with him on it. Natural, even. At least, that's what he had decided at the time. But then it dawned on him. It was also natural for her to suspect him of breaking into that computer, since she was the one who sent him off in that direction. Was she onto him after all? No, she couldn't be. Feng stared out his window. It was late, but there were still office lights on in the building across the street, though not many. Worker ants, just like him. He wondered how many of them were coding, just like... Feng jumped out of his skin at the sound of the knock on his glass door. Larry, still here? Watson leaned in. Yeah, sort of. It's starting to run out of gas. She stepped into his office. It's Saturday night. You should be out enjoying yourself. I am enjoying myself, he said, pointing at a duplicate printer standing next to his desk. I love this spy shit. Besides, look who's talking. She snorted. Guess we are the last two in the office. Don't you have a date or something? Feng's eyes raked over her body. If he wasn't gay, he would definitely be into it. Hiking Mount Tam tomorrow with an old college buddy. Is he cute? She almost blushed. Very. You have any plans for tomorrow? Just sleep. And a little Skype time with Torre. That's good to hear. Tell him I said hello. I will. Don't stay too late. The bad guys got to get their sleep too. I won't. Good night. Good night. Watson turned and left the office, heading for the elevators. Feng watched her enter and turn around. She shot him one last furtive glance, but he caught it. She threw an awkward wave and forced a smile. Feng smiled back as the doors slid shut. Bitch, thought you would never leave. Time to buy some insurance. He bailed out of his programming software and pulled up the building's security cameras. There weren't any located on his floor, where most of CloudServe's security clearance work took place. CloudServe was as paranoid about camera hacking as anyone on the planet. But the cameras the building security deployed in the lobby showed that the two security guards on duty were both seated at the lobby desk, so no chance of them wandering in unexpectedly. Feng dashed over to Watson's office, careful to leave the lights off. He powered up her machine and pulled out the passprint device. It recognized her fingerprint, or at least interpreted one of the tens of thousands of fake ones scrolling through the device as one of her prints. Once inside her computer, he accessed the mirroring program on the NRO computer. But unlike his own setup, there was no automatic log erasure, so his time spent there right now would be recorded as her time spent there. He glanced around the darkened office and the well-lit floor outside. No signs of life. Good. He turned his attention back to the screen. Maybe there was something that Chibi could use. But the only thing on the NRO screen at the moment was a conversation about an airdrop of Romanian AK-47s to a Tuareg militia unit by the Italian Air Force that was to take place tomorrow. Interesting, Feng thought. But since he wasn't getting paid for it, he decided against recording it with the HD digital video camera hidden inside his big analog Tag Heuer watch. Even in broad daylight, it was the most natural gesture in the world for him to put his elbows on the desk and clasp his hands together as if in thought, studying a computer screen, and a simple matter of sliding a finger over and tapping the crown to begin recording, storing the files on a miniature 1 terabyte drive embedded behind the face. If anyone were watching him, they would never suspect what he was up to. Not that anyone ever did. The Immaculate Watch was an awesome device sent to him by Chibi, his Chinese hacker friend. Feng agreed with the enclosed instructions that the video watch was a far safer approach to data transfer than downloading files onto a suspicious thumb drive, wireless or otherwise. Besides, the fewer actions taken on a computer, the better. The NRO might have been installing their own security systems without him knowing about it. Feng did, however, spend the next few minutes rooting around recent communiques between the CIA and other agencies, including assets in the field. He wasn't looking for anything in particular. He just wanted to leave as many incriminating footprints as possible. If the whistle were ever blown, Watson would be the one with mud on her shoes, not him. 10 minutes later, he shut everything down, careful to wipe his own fingerprints off of anything he might have touched. With the floor still clear, he headed back to his desktop and pulled up the building's security logs. He scrolled through the list of people leaving the building and found Watson's name registered and a departure time of 9:28 p.m. He checked his watch. It read 9:49 p.m. It would take him 5 minutes to shut down and less than 10 minutes to get to the lobby to check out. He added a few more minutes and changed Watson's checkout time to 10:14 p.m. His own computer automatically wiped away any digital footprints he might have left behind on the building's security computer, so no chance of that blowing back on him. Satisfied, he shut down his computer and headed for the lobby with a spring in his step. His escort service had scheduled a date for him with his favorite, Roberto, for a weekend debauch in the bridal suite at the Fairmont in less than an hour. Feng was on fire. Roberto had better be ready. Chapter 24 Afrin District, Syria. Captain Akar studied his map in the lamplight inside the cab of his Cobra command vehicle, the Turkish version of the Humvee. The Maroon Beret's Special Forces commander never could sleep before a fight, even one this lopsided. He kept the motor running for heat against the night chill. He took another long drag of his cigarette and checked his watch. Just after 3 a.m. The assault on the sleeping village wouldn't begin for another 2 hours. Covered by Italian-engineered T-129A ATAK helicopter close air support, a platoon of his best commandos was leading a group of 150 Chechen fanatics, former ISIS fighters now converted to the Turkish cause against the Syrian regime. For the past 2 weeks, his combined unit had raided regime-friendly villages behind the lines, gunning down any resistance they encountered, burning down houses and farms, and leaving the women to the tender mercies of the Chechen savages. He was tasked with neutralizing armed opposition and terrorizing the countryside along the northern border to erode the morale of the obstinate Syrian army. With any luck, this part of the border would be absorbed by his own country within the next few months. His battle-weary troops were still bedded down in the barn and outbuildings around the small vacated farm they would burn down later in the day. Better to let them sleep for a few more minutes, he decided. Their bellies were full after yesterday's airdrop by a Lockheed C-130 Hercules cargo plane based at Incirlik. Resupplied with food, water, and ammo, they were well-equipped to resume their terror campaign. The captain yawned and stretched. Time to check with the sentries and fetch another cup of strong black coffee. He stepped out of the cab into the cool night air and crushed the last of his cigarette into the dry dust. The velvet black sky was strewn with a thick blanket of shimmering stars. It nearly took his breath away. It seemed a shame so much ugliness should thrive beneath such quiet beauty. But such was the will of Allah, was it not? Eastern Mediterranean Sea. Captain, second rank, Nikulin, studied the drone's live FLIR feed on the LCD display in the low blue light of the humming CIC. The Project 21631 missile corvette Vishny Volochok was one of the Russian Federation's latest Buyan M-class vessels, specially dispatched from duties with the Black Sea Fleet for this particular mission. The high-altitude black-and-white FLIR imagery displayed the heat differentials of the ground targets below. Chimneys glowed with heat on two of the buildings. Four sentries, or at least the parts of them not covered by uniforms, stood like white ghosts against the dark, cold ground. One figure stood off in a dark patch away from the others, a widening white puddle forming at his feet. Pissing like a cow, Nikulin thought. Enjoy it while it lasts. What caught the captain's eye was the brightest image on his screen. A vehicle with a warm motor glowing white-hot. The FLIR imagery was a clear visual confirmation of the bandit column the FSB report had promised. Better still, the GLONASS tracking device implanted by an FSB agent into the air-dropped ammunition supply was operating perfectly, according to his electronic warfare officer. Two confirmations were more than enough in his mind. It was time. Nikulin gave the order to his weapons control officer. Alarms rang. The first of 8 vertical launch tubes burst with a fiery flash of blinding light as the booster engine of the SS N-30 caliber cruise missile fired in a deafening roar, leaving a trailing plume of white exhaust as it leaped into the dark morning sky thick with stars. 7 more missiles followed in rapid sequence. Seconds later, the boosters fell away and the solid rocket motors of the turbojet engines engaged. Capable of reaching speeds in excess of 0.5 mile per second, the supersonic cruise missiles would strike the objective in northern Syria in less than 4 minutes, delivering each of their 450-kilo high-explosive warheads on target by GLONASS satellite navigation. Afrin District, Syria. Captain Akar stood at the back of the 4x4 Mercedes Axor truck, finishing off a cup of steaming black coffee as his bleary-eyed first sergeant lit a cigarette. He lifted up the pot.
More, sir?
No, I'll just have to piss, the captain said. He slapped the sergeant on the shoulder with a grin. Time to wake the men. The sergeant nodded eagerly, the cherry tip of his cigarette bobbing in the dark. The two men turned to leave, but froze in place. The unmistakable sound of turbojet engines roared in the distance. "Captain!" The first missile struck, vaporizing both men in a ground-shaking explosion that lit the sky in a fiery dawn. Seven more followed in as many seconds. The last explosions of the burning ammo truck echoed in the low hills minutes later. Amid the flames, the screams of the few surviving wounded pierced the night. Proof of concept, number 3. Chapter 25. Washington, D.C. "Lost him," Tyler said. Sandra Kyle tapped the mute button on her cell phone and swore. Tyler was the newest man on her team. She was shorthanded at the moment, and the Ryan Project was top drawer because Senator Dixon was her top priority. Kyle assumed that basic surveillance for an ex-Pinkerton contractor like Tyler wouldn't be a problem. Apparently, she was wrong. The acne-scarred contractor had lost his target. She unmuted her phone. "He knew you were following him?"
"I don't think so. Just running a vehicular SDR.
Just for the hell of it." Kyle couldn't wrap her mind around Clark running a random surveillance detection route. It's normal SOP for high-value targets in high-threat environments to run them. "I wouldn't call Clark a high-value target, and DC isn't exactly the green zone."
"Maybe Clark isn't the high-value component."
"Who's with him in the vehicle?"
"Unknown male. Late 20s, maybe early 30s. Bearded, short hair, clean cut. Blue eyes, dark hair, 6'1 or so, athletic build, maybe 190 or 200 pounds, carry-on leather satchel and a computer bag." Kyle drummed her fingers on the desk. She ran a few dates in her head. Everything but the beard made sense. Kyle had actually met Jack Jr., a college kid at the time, when she was still with the Capitol Police. Nice kid. Good looking. Kind of bookish, too, as she recalled. Georgetown, wasn't it? Yeah, that was it. Just like his old man. That meant he was smart. It wasn't completely crazy that someone like him would work for a financial outfit like Hendley Associates. Jerry Hendley and President Ryan went way back. She could see the president picking up the phone and asking Jerry to do him a favor and hire his kid. Good connections for Hendley, too. But why was Clark playing chauffeur to a suit monkey like Junior? Clark must have been, what, 70-plus years old by now? Too old to be a bodyguard. And besides, that's what the Secret Service was for. So where in the hell was the Secret Service? Something was definitely off about all of this. "You get any pictures of the passenger?"
"Sending now." A moment later, her phone dinged. She checked the photo.
Yeah, that was Junior for sure. Interesting. The president's son.
Where did Clark pick him up?
At an apartment in Alexandria. They left there and headed back over to Hendley Associates. Pulled into the underground parking lot. I couldn't follow. About 20 minutes later, they pulled back out and headed west.
West?
Yeah, surprised me too. I assumed they were headed for the airport. That's when they started their evasion route. After 3 turns, I broke off, as per my SOP.
Kyle sighed. There wasn't any way to run mobile surveillance with just one vehicle on a determined target. Breaking off was the right move. Maybe Tyler wasn't a complete idiot after all.
"Did you get the plate number?"
"Sending now."
Kyle's phone chirped again.
"Good job. You can call it a night."
"Sorry, I dropped the ball, Chief.
This one's on me. I'll take it from here."
Kyle rang off, then dialed another number. A captain in the D.C. Metro Police Department owed her a favor. Last year, his wife contacted Kyle's agency, wanted a surveillance on her husband, whom she suspected of having an affair. She wanted evidence, or more accurately, her divorce attorney did. Kyle agreed. Came back empty-handed.
"You sure?"
the captain's wife replied, stunned and disbelieving.
"I never caught him with another woman," was Kyle's honest answer.
Honest, because Kyle was the woman the captain was sleeping with.
And there was no other woman besides her that she ever saw. Saved the captain half of his pension and six figures in legal fees.
Sandra, to what do I owe the pleasure? The captain said.
Need a favor. The gravelly-voiced captain chuckled.
The long favor or the short one?
I thought you and your wife were back together.
We are, but you know how it is.
Well, the favor I'm asking for is vertical, not horizontal. I need you to track a vehicle for me on the DAS and on the down low.
I'm just about to leave my shift.
It's important.
Give me the details.
Kyle gave the captain the plate number, along with the make, model, and color of the vehicle. She also suggested its final destination.
How long will it take?
Depends on where it lands. If you're right, probably no more than 30 minutes.
Thanks. I owe you one.
And you know how I'll want it paid back, don't you?
Horizontal.
Next Tuesday. My place in Georgetown. 8 o'clock.
Deal.
She didn't mind. Captain Merriweather was a legendary lay. 23 minutes later, Merriweather called.
I just texted you a file. Your car arrived at Dulles 10 minutes ago, headed for the charter jet FBO.
Thanks, DeAndre.
Next Tuesday. Don't forget.
I'll be there with bells on.
He laughed at the imagery. Hope we don't wake the neighbors.
He hung up just as his text message arrived. It was all pictures, each taken from the DCDAS, the Microsoft-branded domain awareness system. The technology was straight out of the television show Person of Interest. The DAS was a surveillance software package that linked thousands of DC metro area cameras, allowing law enforcement to track the movement of people and vehicles in real time. It was even possible to track them 24 hours prior. Everything was recorded, but the city budget allowed for only one day's worth of data storage. Tracking a vehicle was especially easy when the vehicle license plate was known. The DAS even provided a windshield shot of both Clark and Ryan in the front seat of their generic sedan. Exactly the kind of confirmation Kyle liked. Clark had indeed driven aggressively to either avoid or shake any kind of tail. Kyle hoped it was the former. Dixon had been quite specific about not getting caught in the act. The final picture in Merriweather's text was of the car passing through the general aviation gate toward the FBO terminal. But why Dulles? Reagan National was far closer to the Hendley Associates building. Then Kyle remembered. Reagan was good only for domestic flights for private charters. A private charter had to go through either Baltimore or Dulles for international flights. Reagan National didn't have the U.S. Customs and Border Protection facilities needed for international travel on private planes. So Ryan was flying out of the country. But to where? No way to tell from these photos. But Kyle had an idea. She jumped on her laptop and started digging into her favorite databases. Within an hour, she had pieced it all together. Hendley Associates owned a Gulfstream G550. After procuring its tail number, it was a short jump to the FAA database to find the filed flight plan. Bingo. Jack Jr. was heading for Warsaw, Poland. She called Dixon with the intel. Strangely, the senator didn't seem surprised. Chapter 26. Near Rivak, Tajikistan, close to the border of Afghanistan. The big Chinese-built JAC diesel tractor trailer rumbled down the narrow asphalt road at the foot of the gray and rust-colored Pamir Mountains, rising higher the farther west they traveled. Giant sandstone boulders crowded the road shoulder. The driver, Lin, imagined the rocks crashing down from high above centuries ago, or maybe even this morning. Any one of them was big enough to catapult his big red diesel rig into the pale green Hunt River on the other side of the two-lane. Despite his cushioned air suspension seat, Lin's rear end and lower back were trashed after sitting for so many kilometers from Kashgar in Xinjiang, China's westernmost province, where the three-truck convoy had loaded up. His mouth was dry from the bitter tobacco he'd been forced to smoke for the last 3 days, but his screaming bladder told him not to drink any more warm soda. The three-truck convoy was due at its destination in 3 hours, but Lin doubted they would arrive on time. The narrow road twisted and turned as it followed the river, wending its way through the Anticline Mountains, snow-capped in the far distance. The 40-year-old driver lit another cigarette as he began a long turn around the next bend. "Another smoke?" the man in the next seat asked, smiling. He was staring up at the mountains through a monocular pressed against his eye. "Nervous habit," Lin responded, snapping his lighter shut. "Yes, nervous." Lin thought the Frenchman looked a little like the American movie star Matt Damon, in part because he heard one of the other Lao Huai call him Mathieu. His last name was Cluzet. He looked to be 30 years old, if that, and wore his dirty blonde hair short. Cluzet was clean-shaven, unlike his friends, and built like a runner. He seemed unremarkable in most regards, but he was a pleasant fellow, and his Mandarin was good. He wore Levi's, running shoes, and a University of American Samoa Law School sweatshirt. He carried no weapons, not even a knife, and he was in charge. "The mountains are beautiful, and the air is crystal clear," Cluzet said. "You can see forever." He lowered the monocular. They rounded the sharp corner, and Lin slammed his brakes. The truck shuddered to a halt in a whoosh of air brakes. A roadblock. Two battered, open-aired Soviet-era UAZ Jeeps stood bumper to bumper in the middle of the highway. Both drivers flashed AK-47s, and the men in back of each held RPGs on their shoulders. Each bearded man wore the distinctive woolen Afghan pakol cap, including the tallest, a scowling giant standing over 6 feet 5 inches in the middle of the road, a short-barreled AKS-74U rifle draped by his side, held in one hand by the pistol grip. His face was dark and leathered from years in the mountains. His woolly beard shot through with flecks of gray. Cluzet winked at Lin. "I bet now you're really nervous, eh?" Lin tossed his cigarette out the window, mute with fear. He glanced in his side-view mirrors and saw the two other trucks lunging to a halt behind him, rocking on their shocks. It was lucky they didn't crash into him or each other. "Kill the engine," Cluzet ordered as he dropped down out of the high truck cab and approached the giant Afghan. "Salam alaikum," Cluzet offered cheerfully. The grim Afghan leader nodded. "Wa alaikum salam." "What do you want?" Cluzet asked in passable Dari, one of the two major languages here and across the border in Afghanistan. The tall Afghan did a poor job of hiding his surprise that the infidel spoke his language. His wide eyes narrowed. "How long were you in my country?"
"3 years."
"You fought?" Cluzet nodded at the Russian military issue watch on his wrist.
"You did as well, but not Russians. Too young."
The giant smiled broadly, showing a few missing teeth. "My father killed many Russians. He took this from an officer, 103rd Guards Airborne Division." Cluzet smiled in return and held up his arm. A big Casio G-Shock was on his wrist. He tapped it, hopefully.
"Let's trade. Mine is much better."
The Afghan dismissed the smaller, younger man with a shrug.
"I don't want your watch. I want your trucks, or at least what is inside of them."
Cluzet laughed.
"You must be joking. They're full of nothing but DVD players, portable radios, and children's toys."
He nodded toward his armed friends.
"They don't look like children to me."
The Afghan leader shook his head.
"Indeed, they are not. They are men who do what I command."
Cluzet held up his left hand in a peaceful gesture.
"I'm reaching into my back pocket to show you something. Don't get nervous, okay?"
He flashed a friendly smile, then slowly reached into the back pocket of his jeans and extracted a thick wallet. The Afghan leader's dark eyes were fixed on the billfold. Cluzet opened it and pulled out a wad of American $20 bills. U.S. currency was more valuable in this part of the world than local paper. Cluzet held the cash out, and the Afghan slung his weapon. Cluze handed the sack of bills over as he scanned the rocks above. The metallic click of rifles grabbed Cluze's attention. The nervous Afghan drivers raised their AKs as two more Europeans stepped forward, one on each side of Cluze. Unlike Cluze, these two men were armed with pistols holstered on their legs. "These men are my friends. They mean you no harm," Cluze said. Without looking up, the Afghan leader shouted back at his men, "Put your rifles down." The rifles lowered, but the hard stares didn't. "Everything okay, boss?" the man on Cluze's left, a German, asked in English. "Kein Problem," Cluze said. "We're just about done here." The other man, a short, barrel-chested Spaniard, smiled broadly, speaking in a near whisper through clenched teeth, like a ventriloquist. "These guys speak English?" "Not a word." The Spaniard raised his voice, but kept staring at the armed fighters in the jeeps. "I counted 10 men up top." 13, Cluze said, including a sniper on the other side of the river. The Spaniard nodded. "Good eye." $400 American, the Afghan finally said. "Not enough." "But that is all I'm going to give you." Cluze smiled even more broadly than before. "Take it, please." "Do you think I am an idiot? Do foreign devils with guns travel in these mountains to deliver children's toys? Look, I admire you. I really do. You picked a terrific blocking point, a narrow part of the road just around a blind curve. That is very expert. And your men above on both sides with long-range weapons and RPGs. Then you realize I can kill you all and just take what I want." "Of course I do. And I understand you. I really do. You are a businessman, just like me. We can be friends. No need for violence. Just take the money." The Afghan nodded thoughtfully as he pocketed the money. "Yes, I will take the money." His fierce scowl broke into a wide grin. "And your trucks." Cluze shook his head as he ran his fingers through his hair. "That is truly unfortunate, my friend." The Afghan suddenly noticed the tattoo on the Frenchman's forearm, a wing with an arm and a sword. He didn't recognize it for what it was. The arm of the Archangel Michael, the patron saint of the 12th Régiment Étranger du Parachutistes of the French Foreign Legion. "Fortunate or not, I am taking what I want. Stand aside or I will kill you and take it anyway." He raised his weapon. "I don't fear a man with a woman's smooth face." Cluze rubbed his beardless face. "Yes, smooth. Like Setara's, I imagine. She's your youngest wife, right? The prettiest, at least. I should think she would like my face." The Afghan chieftain scowled with confusion. "You know my wife's name?" Cluze's boyish charm suddenly vanished, his face hardening like the limestone looming above their heads. "Pull out your phone, Behzad Katlani, and call her now." "How do you know these things? You are a devil." "My job is to know everything. Call now, or you will regret it." Katlani marched over to his jeep, and his driver handed him his phone. He dialed. A moment later, a panicked woman's voice answered. "Our sons, Behzad, please," a woman's voice shouted over the speaker. Everyone could hear it. "What is happening? Foreigners, infidels, rifles, machine guns, vehicles. They have rounded us all up. They said they will kill us." "How many?" "I don't know," she cried. "Many." Katloni's eyes widened with rage. He turned toward the Frenchman. "What is this?" "All of your fighters are here. If you don't leave in the next 60 seconds, my men will burn your village, kill your elderly, rape your women, and your sons." The Afghan whipped a long chura knife from its sheath and lunged at Cluze, landing the blade millimeters from Cluze's neck before the other two mercenaries could react. "Call them off." Cluze didn't flinch. He could smell the stink of Catlone's breath. My men have their orders. They will slit your children's throats, drop their bodies into the dung trench, and piss on them. He pressed the T-shaped blade against Cluzet's throat. Have you no fear?
Yes, of boredom.
The Afghan's men stirred anxiously, worried about their own families. Cluzet's men stayed frozen in place, ready to pounce on command. The giant Afghan searched Cluzet's unblinking eyes.
You are the spawn of Satan.
Probably. 30 seconds. Catlone cursed, sheathing his blade. He barked orders to his men. The jeep engines fired up, and he turned to leave.
Not yet, Cluzet said.
The Afghan spun around.
What? Your watch.
Catlone stiffened.
Are you insane?
Your watch, now, or I don't call.
You would kill my children for a cursed watch.
Cluzet shrugged, puzzled.
Yes, I would.
The Afghan clawed at the watch's wristband, grunting with frustration.
I hate you devils. You curse my land.
Yes, I suppose we do. But it's an interesting way to pass the time. The Afghan flung the freed watch at Cluzet, who caught it with a laugh.
Make the damn call, infidel.
The Spaniard reached behind his back and handed Cluzet a sat phone as Catlone piled into his jeep. The engines roared and the two UAZs sped away in a screech of smoking tires burning on the asphalt. Cluzet punched numbers on the sat phone, catching the puzzled gaze of his two men. He turned around and saw Lin in the cab of the truck, his white-knuckled hands welded to the steering wheel in abject terror. Cluzet turned to the German, grinning.
I think that went very well, don't you?
Chapter 27. Badakhshan Province, northeastern Afghanistan. It was a clear, cool morning. The sky a blue so brilliant it hurt Cluzet's eyes as he stared at it, sipping a hot tea. His three tractor trailers stood beneath tents of heavy camouflage netting to mask the heat signatures of the big diesel engines and to avoid the prying eyes of the school bus-sized KH-11 keyhole satellite passing over Afghanistan nearly 15 times per day at a mean altitude of 400 kilometers. The satellite's optical sensors were capable of seeing objects just 4 inches across in broad daylight, but it also possessed thermal and infrared capabilities. Deployed primarily to assist U.S. and ISAF coalition military operations, it was sometimes tasked with drug interdiction assignments for the ISAF and the Afghan Army. Given their remote location, unless the KH-11 satellite was tasked with a mission specifically directed at them, they were likely safe. Still, as far as Cluzet was concerned, it never hurt to be too careful. The first items that had been unloaded and restacked overnight from the trailers were pallets of Bego brand Star Battles toys, Chinese knockoffs of the famous Lego Star Wars building block sets. The rest were, as Cluzet told Catlone, pallets of Chinese-manufactured DVD players and portable radios. Once the cheap Chinese goods were unloaded, it was possible to remove the dozens of 200-liter plastic drums of chemical precursors for the manufacture of heroin. Despite decades of American and European interdiction efforts, Afghan heroin production was at an all-time high at nearly 500,000 acres of poppies, the equivalent of 500,000 American football fields, not including end zones, producing an estimated 9,000 metric tons of refined product, the vast majority of global heroin sourcing. While there was no shortage of poppies to produce the raw opium latex typically harvested by Afghan children, the largely agrarian and dysfunctional Afghan economy was incapable of producing the hydrochloric acid, acetic anhydride, and other chemical precursors required in the otherwise simple heroin manufacturing process. European governments had successfully monitored legal shipments of these important chemicals used in many industrial and pharmaceutical applications, and had even managed to clamp down on the illegal distribution of them. Chinese government officials, who were secretly part of the global criminal enterprise known as the Iron Syndicate, were more than happy to fill in the gap. The Iron Syndicate rerouted the heroin precursor chemicals into Afghanistan under official cover, with all necessary documentation out of Kashgar, an ancient city along the original Silk Road of Marco Polo fame in China's far western Xinjiang province. The city had enjoyed a great deal of German foreign investment of late, including with development of the largest and most sophisticated chemical plants in Central Asia, with managers on the Iron Syndicate payroll. Clouzet and his team were hired to provide security for the illicit chemical shipment needed in the process to transform raw opium into a morphine base, then into brown tar heroin, and finally grade 4 pure white heroin. Delivering the 4 tons of precursors was only half of Clouzet's dangerous assignment. The second half was even more treacherous, delivering 1 metric ton of processed heroin to the shipyards in Gdansk. The distribution and sale of the final heroin product would generate just over $200 million of profit for his employer and their Afghan producers. The Afghans unloaded the pallets of radio cases with the aid of a rusted 1964 Massey Ferguson forklift tractor conversion and stacked them inside a cinder block storage shed where young village women began their work. They first opened the cases of radios, then pulled out individual units, carefully opened the boxes, and removed the specially designed digital radios, mindful not to damage the packaging or lose the instructions. Individual radios were pried open, and a package of heroin was placed inside a storage compartment. Once a radio was loaded with heroin, it was placed back in its packaging box, and the box was resealed. Then the box was marked with a small brown sticker, round and innocuous. The heroin radio was then put back in the case of clean radios, and the process repeated. Only 1 in 4 of the radios carried the illicit drug. Once finished with the pallets of radios, the women moved on to the DVD players and finally the children's toys. While the women continued stashing heroin packets, men unloaded the heavy barrels of dangerous chemical precursors and transported them gingerly to the heroin processing lab with the help of the wheezing tractor. The Afghan in charge of the mobile heroin processing station, Akhtar Hayat, was a 24-year-old gray-eyed Pashtun with a chemistry degree from a university in Peshawar, Pakistan. He and Clouzet had worked together before. Clouzet's team was spread out around the camp, cleaning weapons, eating food, or catching up on sleep, including the Ingush mercs he'd hired for the job, murderous Caucasian cousins of the Chechens. 2 of his men he kept on sentry duty. His walkie-talkie crackled with chatter in Pashtun. One of Hayat's sentries called in over the radio, "A devil's chariot, 10 kilometers out." A devil's chariot, the Afghan term for the hated Mi-35 Hind helicopters flown by the Afghan Air Force, was bad news for Hayat, Clouzet knew. His wasn't a Taliban combat unit, per se. Hayat's job was to cook heroin, bag it, and ship it on. His small band had only AKs and RPG-7s for defense against bandits or rival gangs. The 40-millimeter rocket-propelled grenades were powerful enough to blast away a rotor assembly, even on the heavily armored Russian helicopter. But the RPG-7 had an effective range of only 200 meters. Every helicopter pilot who had ever flown in Afghanistan over the last 40 years knew to stay high off the deck, especially in the mountains. Clouzet didn't wait for Hayat's panicked call. An attack by the heavily armed machine, called the Flying Tank by the Russians who built them, would be catastrophic. A lone Hind, though, likely wasn't on a combat mission. Quite possibly it was on a surveillance run, or even just a training exercise. But discovery of their operation or his convoy when it pulled out in the morning would be equally disastrous. Either outcome would interrupt his assignment, something both he and the Iron Syndicate took very seriously. Failure was not an option. The hind had to be destroyed. The lookout called in the incoming direction of the hind as Clouzet whistled up his number two and designated spotter, the German, an ex-KSK, Commando Spezialkräfte sergeant named Monstein. The two of them jogged over to the back of a Range Rover. Clouzet grabbed the FIM 92B Stinger man pads from its locker in the back of the vehicle, and Manstein fetched range-finding binoculars. The two of them scrambled to higher ground as the mountains began to echo with the whirring doom of the Heinz rotors beating the thin, cool air. "Got him," Manstein said, pointing toward the southwest. "I'd say 1,000 meters elevation above our position." With the 5-foot-long launcher balanced on his shoulder, Clouzet slammed home the battery cooling unit into the stock's pistol grip and twisted it, powering up the missile with a thermal battery and cooling the seeker to operating temperature with argon gas. He lifted the launcher in the direction Manstein was pointing and glanced over the top of the sight. "Yes, I see him. About 4 kilometers out and 1 kilometer altitude. Well within range of the fearsome Stinger." "Confirmed." Manstein kept his binoculars fixed on the hind. Clouzet raised the launcher even higher and put his eye to the sight. In order to set the UVIR tracker, he lined up the sight above the helicopter against the clear blue sky as he pressed down and in on the safety and actuator switch. This immediately initiated a howling tone over the small speaker that also shot through his skull, thanks to the vibration of the small transducer pressed against his cheekbone. He lined up the hind in the canoe between the forward range ring and the rear reticle. Once the tracker locked in the negative UV, the light blocked out by the chopper, the tone changed sharply, telling Clouzet his missile was also locked in. Clouzet uncaged the missile with the press of his left index finger, releasing the missile's seeker eye to follow the hind independently. He super-elevated the launcher at an exaggerated angle and depressed the trigger, holding it until... whoosh! The missile's small ejection motor fired, spitting the 22-pound missile out of the tube, just far enough to clear away safely from Clouzet before falling away. The now powerless missile dropped a few inches before the second, more powerful two-stage solid-fuel flight motor engaged, driving the missile toward the hind at nearly 2,400 feet per second, almost 10 times faster than its target. A plume of white rocket exhaust trailed behind the speeding Stinger. The hind instantly fired countermeasure flares and chaff, but the Stinger's UVIR homing system was impervious to them. In just over 5 seconds after launch, the missile's 6.6-pound high-explosive fragmentation warhead ripped into the airframe. A secondary explosion erupted in the fuel tank, and the flaming 9-ton wreckage plummeted toward the Earth. Clouzet lowered the launcher, a smile plastered across his boyish face. His green eyes tracked the falling wreckage until it crashed in a fiery heap on the valley floor far down below. The irony wasn't lost on him that he'd just shot down a Russian helicopter flown by an Afghan pilot. It used to be Afghans that shot down Russian pilots. But always, it was the Stinger that was the victor. "Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose." "Nice shot," Manstein said, clapping him on the back. "Hard to miss a flying brick." Clouzet checked his recently acquired Russian airborne watch. "Let's get all hands on deck and help these mountain goats to finish up. We need to get this shipment loaded up fast and get out of here and on the road before another helicopter comes looking for their dead friends." "The English won't like it," Manstein said. "They're fighters, not stevedores." "They like getting 80-millimeter Russian rockets up the ass even less," Clouzet said. "Now go." Chapter 28. Warsaw, Poland. Jack wasn't embarrassed to admit that flying in the Hendley Associates Gulfstream G550 was better than first-class commercial any day. No TSA lines at the terminal, no waiting to board, no coughing kids throwing snot and bacteria into the air, and no snoring seatmates. Well, unless Ding Chavez was sacked out somewhere in the cabin. It was expensive for Jerry to fly him over in an empty plane, but it was his call to make, and Jack was grateful. It was a great time saver on an assignment he really hadn't wanted to take. He had an obligation to fulfill on the other side of the planet, and it bothered him like hell to put it off a single day longer than necessary. The G-550 executive jet kissed the tarmac under the steady hand of Captain Helen Reed and her first officer co-pilot, Chester Country Hicks, at Warsaw Chopin, the capital city's principal airport and the largest one in Poland. Captain Reed taxied to a small private terminal of a local fixed base operator that Lizanne Robertson, the director of transportation for Hendley Associates and the campus, had contracted with for refueling and scheduled maintenance services, in addition to landing rights. Jack yawned as he pulled on his sport coat. The overnight flight had taken just over 10 hours nonstop, well within the range of the Gulfstream's twin Rolls-Royce engines. He originally planned to sleep on the way over, but decided instead to dig a little deeper into the few files he had on Gage Capital Partners and the 24 shell companies he'd found connected with Aaron and his son Christopher. He finally managed to squeeze in a power nap an hour before they landed, and Lizanne had whipped up a couple of cups of strong black coffee and a spicy turkey sausage and egg breakfast sandwich for him to wolf down before landing. It was too bad Midas, Bartosz Jankowski, was stuck in the Philippines on a campus assignment. He'd never heard the former ranger talk about his parents' native homeland, nor did he ever mention spending time in Poland. But Midas spoke the language fluently, as well as Russian. The former Delta recce was damned handy to have in a gunfight, too, though the only wounds Jack anticipated receiving on this trip were paper cuts from an accounts receivable ledger, if he could ever lay his hands on one. We're wheels up in 8 hours. Any chance you'll be done by then? Happy to give you a lift back if you don't mind an overnight in London. Jack tried to hide his disappointment. Isabel was still in London, staying with her parents. It would be a convenient excuse to visit her without actually being invited and try to figure out what was going on between the two of them. If anything, Jack thought. He was beginning to wonder if her radio silence was more than just rest and recuperation. Their time together in Afghanistan proved they both still cared for each other. On the other hand, it also proved they still had unresolved issues. Right now, he wasn't sure which side would win out in the end. Sadly, no. Could be 8 hours or 8 months before I get to the bottom of this thing. What can I do to help? Jack smiled. Lizanne knew how to handle weapons, how to clear a room, and how to kick ass, generally, besides being fluent in Arabic. However, as far as he knew, she had no forensic accounting skills, so there wasn't much she could do to help, and even if she could, she hadn't been read into his assignment. But it was her nature to be helpful, no matter the circumstances. It was just one of the many reasons she'd been the perfect person to replace Adara Sherman as the director of transportation. Maybe a short prayer for patience. I'll be pushing on a string uphill in the dark until I can figure this thing out. Beats shoveling shit in Louisiana, to borrow a phrase. Couldn't say. I've never been to Louisiana. Jack poked his head in the cockpit to shake hands with Reed and Hicks and thank them for the great flying before Lizanne handed him his leather satchel and laptop case. Safe travels, she said. You too. Jack descended the cabin stairs to the tarmac. The darkening sky threatened rain and a slight breeze tousled his dark hair. The gloomy weather didn't particularly bother him, but neither did it help his mood. He proceeded into the private hangar and offices of the FBO, where he passed through customs quickly and without incident, another check mark in the private charter column. With his two bags and a freshly stamped passport, he headed out the front door of the mini-terminal in search of his Polish contact, Jerzy Krakowiak, the 57-year-old ABW agent Jerry had arranged for him to meet. Jack approached the curb, scanned the street. Where the hell was he? Jack Ryan, a woman's voice. Jack turned around. He was greeted by the confident but exhausted gaze of a striking blonde, blue-eyed woman about his age. She stood in front of a silver Audi A5 coupe parked at the curb behind her, a shoulder holster printed beneath her loose-fitting blue blazer. Not what he was expecting, but better than a kick in the head. Yeah, that's me. She thrust out her hand. Hello, Mr. Ryan. My name is Liliana Pilitsky. I'm with the ABW. Jack hesitated. This was highly unusual.
Where is Mr. Krakowiak?
I'm sorry, he can't be here. He was struck by a car in a hit and run last night. He was put into a medically induced coma just an hour ago.
I'm really sorry to hear that. My grandfather was a cop. Is he going to pull through?
Yerzhe is a strong man. I pray he will survive this.
No wonder she looks exhausted, Jack thought. You look like you've been through the ringer. He must be your partner.
I sat with his wife during surgery. It was a long night.
Was it an accident or intentional?
We're still investigating. The car was found 3 kilometers away from the crime scene, burned to the ground.
How did you identify the car?
We tracked it through CCTV traffic cameras. The car was stolen. We couldn't identify the driver.
I hate to ask, but how about you show me your credentials?
Yes, of course.
She reached into her coat pocket and pulled out a small leather billfold and handed it to Jack. It was all in Polish, naturally. He had a little Russian under his belt, but it didn't help.
Thanks.
He handed it back to her. Look, you've got a lot going on. I can catch an Uber to my hotel, and don't be ridiculous. My supervisor briefed me on the assignment and forwarded me Jerry Hendley's email request. I'm just driving you around and translating when necessary. It's not a problem for me, honestly.
She frowned. Didn't you get Mr. Hendley's text?
Crap. Jack hadn't checked his phone since landing. He powered it up. There it was, with her name in the address next to his. Change of plans. Agent Liliana Pilecki will be taking care of you over there. Call me if there's a problem.
Jack rubbed his tired eyes. Sorry about that, Ms. Pilecki. I'm a little off my game this morning. I appreciate you picking me up and dragging my sorry butt around.
Can I help you with your bags?
No, I'm fine, thanks.
Jack stifled a jagged yawn with the back of his hand.
You look jet-lagged. I'll drop you off at your hotel, and we can get started later this afternoon, perhaps.
No, I'm fine. I want to get after it right away.
As you wish.
Liliana popped the trunk of her Audi, and Jack dropped in his bags. Minutes later, they were on a tree-lined four-lane road crowded with commuters, heading for the city center, where modern skyscrapers loomed in the distance.
Have you ever been to Warsaw before, Mr. Ryan?
Or Poland?
Please, call me Jack.
And no, it's my first time.
Jack glanced out the rain-spattered passenger window. A lot of greenery and clean streets. The storm was picking up. It's a nice city.
The first few drops of rain hit the windshield. The automatic wipers kicked on.
It's big for me. I originally came from a smaller town just outside of Krakow in the south, but I love it here.
Your English is superb, by the way.
Thank you. I have family in Chicago. I did a year abroad program there in high school, and another 2 years in college at Loyola, where I majored in piano and minored in accounting.
Interesting combination.
Accounting was my father's idea. He was a very practical person.
He's passed away.
Last year, prostate cancer. He was a good man.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
So how long have you been in the ABW?
5 years.
Do they need a lot of piano players in your department?
She laughed.
A pleasant surprise for them both.
Not many, no. It was my accounting degree that got me in, how do you say, by the skin of my teeth?
And such pretty teeth they were, Jack noticed. Also, no wedding ring. But Bosnia had taught him a few more lessons about women, so he told himself to throttle back. So, how did you go from piano recitals to packing heat?
My sister overdosed on heroin the year I graduated.
That's terrible. I'm so sorry.
Death is not such a stranger in Poland, but thank you. After she died, I felt so helpless, so angry. The ABW was a place where I thought I might be able to do some good. Perhaps save someone else's sister. It was the least I could do.
Drugs are a poison killing the entire West, Jack said. Over 70,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year. More Americans than died in the Vietnam War. It's a big problem all over Europe, too, and getting worse here every day. My casework is focused on organized crime, so drugs and drug money play a big part in my investigations.
And then you got stuck with me. I would hardly say stuck. I'm happy to assist you in any way that I can.
I appreciate it.
But how can you help me? Jack wondered. I can't exactly tell you I'm hunting for dirt on an American senator.
Besides the fact that he was under strict orders from Jerry to keep it quiet, Jack didn't much like the idea of showing America's dirty underwear to an agent of a foreign security service, even an allied one.
If you don't mind my saying, I am a big fan of your president, Liliana said. He had the guts to stand up to the Russians when most NATO leaders didn't want to.
I'm a big fan, too. And no, I don't mind you saying it.
You are a financial analyst with Hendley Associates, correct?
Yes.
Interesting that your boss, Mr. Hendley, is close friends with the head of the ABW.
Jerry was formerly a U.S. senator. He knows a lot of